Claire, you rolling?
Hell yeah.
All right, well, let's do this. Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. Georgia Congressman and civil rights leader John Lewis passed away last week. Now, for decades, black politicians who came up through the civil rights era and who represented districts that were, in many cases, created as a result of the Voting Rights Act, have been highly influential in black politics. So today, we'll be reflecting on the legacy of Lewis's generation and also ask who is next in line. We're also going to take a look at the state of the race for the Senate. Republicans are defending a Senate map that once upon a time might not have looked so difficult. They need to hold on to or flip seats in places like Georgia, Alabama, Montana, North Carolina, and Kansas. But increasingly, it looks like it could actually be a challenge. And here with me to discuss are senior politics writer Claire Malone. Hey, Claire.
Hi, Galen.
And senior politics writer Perry Bacon Jr. Hello, Perry.
Hey, good morning. Good to see you, Galen.
You too. And also here with us is 538 Elections Analyst Nathaniel Rakich. Hello, Nathaniel, and welcome.
Howdy, Galen.
And Nate Silver is hard at work trying to finish up the election forecast, so we've given him the day off, and I don't have any insight on when it's going to be published, but I appreciate everyone's excitement for it. So we've got plenty to discuss today, as I mentioned, but before we get into any of it, let's begin with one of our favorite questions, which is, of course, good use of polling or bad use of polling. So last week, Monmouth released a poll of Pennsylvania that had a lot of listeners writing to us with questions. The poll showed that Biden had a 13-point lead over Trump in the state among registered voters. But the thing that really caught people's attention was that, according to the poll, 57%, so the majority of Pennsylvanians, believed that there are a number of so-called secret voters in their communities who support Trump but won't tell anyone about it. So secret Trump voters, essentially. That compares with just 27% of respondents who thought there were secret Biden voters. This is not the first time we've addressed this question. I think it came up plenty in 2016. But let's talk about it given the hindsight of 2016 and that clearly a lot of people think that secret Trump voters exist. So, Nathaniel Rakich, kick us off. Is there any reason to believe that there is a secret Trump vote?
There is little evidence for this so-called shy Trump voter phenomenon. Look, you know, I'm not going to stand here and say that there are zero people in the world who might have social desirability bias, but it's not a significant number of people. So we went over this after the 2016 election. If this were a widespread thing, you would expect that the polls would have underestimated Donald Trump everywhere. And in fact, maybe even they would do so more in these deep blue areas where Trump voters maybe face a lot of peer pressure not to support Trump. But in fact, that's not what we saw in 2016. The polls underestimated Trump the most in red states, and certainly infamously or famously, depending on which side you're on, in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in Pennsylvania. But in blue states like California and the Northeast, the polls actually overestimated Trump. So that doesn't track with that. You could just as easily say that there's a hidden Clinton vote in these states, slash Biden vote this year, I guess. In addition, theoretically, the social desirability bias would go down if you have a poll conducted by robocalls or online, as opposed to with a live interviewer. You know, theoretically, somebody would be more likely to fill in a form online that says that they're voting for someone they think is racist than to tell a real life person. Several pollsters, including President Trump's own pollster in the 2016 election, did simultaneous phone and online polls in 2016 and found that there was really only a 1 or 2 or 3 point gap between the results of those polls, which is not statistically significant. So there might be a few shy Trump voters out there. We know from Twitter that there are always a couple of, you know, naughty people who say they lie to pollsters, but these are not significantly affecting the results
naughty.
Anyway.
Naughty.
So where is this idea coming from? Because even before Trump won in 2016, there was already this idea that people were potentially lying to pollsters or being influenced by the social desirability that we've talked about on this podcast before and saying that they supported somebody other than Trump when indeed they planned on voting for Trump. So where does this all come from? Why did people believe this? Why do they still believe this?
I mean, I think it's such an interesting polling question for them to have done. I think there are perhaps others that are more worthwhile, but it is such an interesting psychological phenomenon in America that people think their neighbors are lying about something. Why are they lying about something? Because Donald Trump is taboo. Which is not to say people love taboo things, right? Like, well, I don't need to give anyone examples. But I think the idea that people would hide their Trump vote is a very natural thing to probably most Americans, as demonstrated by the poll, because Trump says taboo things, and even if it's not true, people are willing to believe that other people want to keep a secret of Trump. Rakich has already sort of thoroughly outlined why it's probably not a real phenomenon, but I find it so interesting that this majority of Pennsylvania voters believes in this. It's almost like a light conspiracy, right? People are hiding things from me.
Right, Claire, I mean, I would say that it's probably also a phenomenon that's limited to liberal voters because they're the ones who see Trump as taboo. Like, you know, we don't love to bring out anecdotes on this podcast, but, you know,
sure we do.
Trump voters I have met, fair, the Trump voters I've met are not shy about saying that they support Trump. So, you know, I don't think that a lot of Republicans are feeling like there's something to be ashamed of in their support for Trump.
Yeah, I guess what I meant when I said Trump is sort of taboo is also, I think Trump also becomes synonymous with, lately, racism or saying racist things or saying outlandish things. And so that, I think, is something that people would think, oh, well, maybe you'd want to sort of hide that in polite society. Because I think there are, again, probably in liberal corners, but there is a pretty strong connection these days of Trump and racism.
Yeah, I'm interested, Perry. Last week, we talked a little bit about social desirability bias in some polling of white Democrats who may have overemphasized their support for particular policies that might reduce racial inequalities. So I'm curious, like, why, you know, we talked about that quite a bit as a factor in how Democrats might respond to these polls. Why is it different in this case, do you think?
I mean, the short answer is we have a lot of evidence that white Democrats who may express desirability to work on racial inequality often don't support school integration plans or things like that. That's happening in real life. On the other hand, most Republicans are saying they're voting for Trump in the poll and then voting for Trump. There's not a big gap between action and belief. I would say, and it's worth thinking about, that poll overall that we're talking about showed Trump at 40 in Pennsylvania. We're seeing a lot of polls right now where Trump is in this 38 to 42 range. I don't think Trump is going to get 40 in Pennsylvania. I think he's going to get something like 44 or 45. So I do think, I'm not saying that people are lying. I do think there is right now, there are some people who are likely to vote for Trump in November who are telling pollsters they're undecided right now. And they maybe are kind of shy about supporting Trump in this moment. But I'm not saying they're lying. I think they're calling themselves undecided. But I think they will decide to be Republicans like they always are in November.
I think Perry is right, but I think that when people talk about shy Trump voters, that's not what they're talking about. You know, they're talking about the polls were wrong in 2016, and I have to explain this somehow. You know, frankly, that happens a lot. I mean, in fact, one of the problems with the polls in 2016 was that there were a lot of undecided voters, and, you know, they just broke a certain way, especially these voters, you know, we've talked about them before, who disliked both Trump and Clinton. And this year, the candidates are much better defined. They were well defined last time, too, but people just know where they stand on Biden and Trump, and there are a lot fewer undecided voters, and that is going to contribute less to uncertainty in the polls, hopefully. But yeah, you know, obviously you see the polls that say, you know, Biden 50 and Trump 40, but there's obviously 10% of people who are still undecided in that, and those people can vote, can go in whichever direction they want to go. So that, there's nothing unusual about that.
Yeah. Claire, you were talking about how it's just interesting that this question was asked on a poll. Can we take away from that number, 57% of registered voters in Pennsylvania think that there are secret Trump voters, to mean that the majority of people don't trust polls? Because presumably, if you think people aren't telling the truth to pollsters, then you don't have much reason to believe the numbers that the poll produces. Like, is this kind of getting at a deeper thing here where people still don't trust polls in the wake of 2016?
I'd love to see some polling on whether or not people trust polls. But I think popularly, certainly, that is a big theme in American life. Anecdotally, in my life, right after 2016, I mean, that was the question I was most frequently asked for, I would say, a solid year, was what happened with the polls. So I think that that's certainly something that's a prevailing thread in American life. It's, I mean, and it's one of the reasons why you could see pretty serious politicians, like I believe Elizabeth Warren would say, you know, like, I don't have pollsters, right? I'm just going on my gut. Some of that is like, you know.
Good thing she did that strategy.
Yeah, exactly. Some of it's just some of it's just rhetorical, but it's why do you choose a rhetorical thing to say like that over and over again? It's because people don't like the idea of polls for lots of reasons, but in part because they just think that they're bullshit.
This segment is called Good and Bad Use of Polling, so I'm going to make a statement here. I think this is a bad use of polling. Ooh. I don't think people are great at pundicizing, and I think asking people questions about things like, are the secret Trump voters or not? They have no idea.
Yeah.
They know what they think. They have some unformed views about it. I don't know that we should poll people about things that actually have a lot of research behind them and ask them randomly, are polls accurate? Most people have no idea the answer to that question. I mean, let me be very harsh here. It suggests the pollster did not believe their own poll showing Biden ahead by 13 and wanted to soften it by saying, oh, our poll may not be right according to these people.
Oh, interesting.
Over here.
I didn't
like, that's kind of how I took it, because I think this is a sort of a silly question.
I didn't take it that way. Although that's interesting, Perry. But yeah, I agree.
The headline, if you look at it, yeah.
I agree. That's sort of why I said at the very top is that I'm sort of interested that they even did this question because there's a lot of stuff going on.
So where do you come down, Claire? Good use of polling or bad use of polling?
Wasteful use of polling.
I think that sounds bad to me. Nathaniel, before we move on, where are you coming down on this poll?
Yeah, this is a bad use of polling for a lot of the reasons that Perry said. I just think that when most people in the media report on the results of this poll, they're not going to include all the caveats, including the evidence that shy Trump voters weren't really a thing in 2016, and therefore people are going to be misled because of this.
All right, a resounding bad use of polling. Sorry, Monmouth. Mix it up next time. Ask a different question.
We love Monmouth, for the record. They are our top-rated poll in our pollster ratings. So
wait, really?
They're very good and accurate. Yeah. They're an excellent pollster. Don't agree with this particular choice of question.
All right, that's fair. Let's move on and talk about John Lewis's passing and who the ascendant leaders are in Black politics. Today's podcast is brought to you by Shopify. Ready to make the smartest choice for your business? Say hello to Shopify, the global commerce platform that makes selling a breeze. Whether you're starting your online shop, opening your first physical store, or hitting a million orders, Shopify is your growth partner. Sell everywhere with Shopify's all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system. Turn browsers into buyers with Shopify's best converting checkout, 36% better than other platforms. Effortlessly sell more with Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Did you know Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. and supports global brands like Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen? Join millions of successful entrepreneurs across 175 countries backed by Shopify's extensive support and help resources. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Start your success story today. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/538. That's the numbers, not the letters. Shopify.com/538. For decades, John Lewis and his generation of politicians who came up through the civil rights era have been highly influential in Congress and in Black politics more broadly. And as they leave office and we reflect on their legacy, there's a question of who will replace them. Perry, you started to address this question in part in a piece that you wrote for the site a few weeks back, in which you described the competing camps in Black politics. There is, for example, a younger establishment, then there are Obama-aligned politicians, there's a Black left that is increasingly winning seats. So let's talk about those dynamics. But before we get into that, let's look back a little bit on Lewis's legacy and his generation's legacy. So what role over the past, say, 60 years has that part of the Democratic Party and that part of Black politics played?
That's a hard question. But I think a very general way to think about this might be, we had in the 60s this protest movement led by Martin Luther King Jr. with a lot of other people involved in it, and I don't want to minimize their roles at all. And then what you saw next was in the 70s and the 80s was that a lot of people who were involved or connected to that movement ran for politics. So the 70s, 80s, 90s, you see a lot of black House members, you see a lot of black mayors, you didn't see a lot of black governors, you didn't see a lot of black senators. And often the black people are mainly representing heavily black constituencies. So cities like Washington, D.C., cities like Atlanta, you know, a lot of districts that are designed specifically to have a majority black population and therefore to elect a black member of Congress. So, for example, right now we have the largest congressional black caucus ever. I think it's 46 members, if I remember correctly. Of course, I didn't mention that at some point we have a big political class of black figures that are representing mostly heavily black areas, and then Barack Obama runs for president. And so he is sort of introduces a different element of this. As you had a previous generation of black politicians who in some ways were sort of expected to and kind of did represent black interests in sort of a broader way. And then you had Obama, who had a kind of a different style. I mean, I remember at some point he actually said, I'm not the president of black America, I'm the president of all America. And so you had a different style with that. And so coming out of the Obama era, you have, I would say, at least three different styles of politicians. You have a figure like John Lewis. John Lewis represented a heavily black district. He was sort of expected to and kind of thought of himself as speaking for black interest. You have a sort of Obama-like figures. Obama's still alive, obviously. You have Stacey Abrams. You have Kamala Harris, who are kind of running in that image, I would say. And increasingly, we also have this black left, which I think you describe as maybe Jamal Bowman of New York. You might see Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts. And there's other styles. I'm stereotyping grossly, but those are like three styles of black politicians we're seeing in the future.
Is it clear right now the ascendant part of black politics, whether it's the left, the Obamaites, or whether it's still the establishment in the vein of John Lewis?
I don't think there is going to be a sort of dominant style in the future. I mean, I guess you could say, okay, so Joe Biden in the center-left moderate group of the Democratic Party is ascended right now. So if you wanted to say that, I think it's more likely that Hakeem Jeffries, who's from New York and kind of a more moderate member, is more likely to be Speaker of the House than Ayanna Pressley. So I think in the short term, I do think this more moderate, less kind of left-wing black politician will have more power in the Democratic Party in the same way that the white equivalents will. But I'm not sure that that's going to last forever.
A thing I thought was interesting about your piece, Perry, was that you did point out some of the geographic diversity in some of the new black left voices and the fact that some of them are from districts that are also pretty heavily white. I think this is like this applies across Congress in general in the Democratic caucus, but that certain districts desire certain candidates, and that's probably true black or white, right? Like a certain district in Georgia might prefer a moderate candidate versus an area of Minneapolis would prefer a left-leaning candidate and probably a candidate of color if its liberal residents are looking to put sort of like their money where their mouth is. So I thought that that was an interesting element to sprinkle in.
Yeah, there's a school of thought that the Voting Rights Act, which mandated that, you know, especially the southern states where there are areas with strong concentrations of black voters, that they draw districts that are majority black or can elect the preferred candidates of black voters, in the immediate term, provided for the election of several new black members of Congress, as Perry was saying. But there's also a school of thought that that in the longer term was holding back black voters because of, you know, you've seen over time, we've only had a handful of black senators, we've only had a handful of black governors. And what's interesting about this kind of new wave of progressive black politicians is that they represent districts that are not majority black. You know, the Elliott Engel, now Jamal Bowman's district, it's very diverse, but it is plurality white. So I do think that that is interesting that that's starting to break through. And, you know, and I also think that a lot of these politicians, their bases are white, racially progressive voters, just as much as they are black voters themselves.
And Nathaniel, the idea that these majority black districts were holding back black politicians is because what they didn't have experience just representing the kind of broader coalitions required of winning statewide elections.
Right. Yeah. Along those lines.
Particularly the black left that has been winning more seats. As we mentioned, Ayanna Pressley, we now have Jamal Bowman, Ilhan Omar, for example. That part of the party, that part of black politics, has been somewhat critical of the Congressional Black Caucus, of prominent leaders like James Clyburn, who is the majority whip, basically saying that the Congressional Black Caucus has been too moderate and, as a result, ineffective, and in some ways too entrenched within establishment Democratic politics to fight for black interests as aggressively as some people would like to see. How dominant is that view, Perry? Is that like a small part of the party that is only in districts where they're electing, say, Ayanna Pressley? Or is this a broader view, and is it going to be a conflict that kind of comes to the fore?
We have so few polls of black voters that it'd be hard for you to sort of analyze their views on a elite political conflict. So if you talk to the people who are protesting and who've been protesting the last 8 weeks, what they would say is that we have a lot of black city council members, black mayors, and black congressmen, and the racial inequality in the country has not changed very much. And so they would say that to some extent, the black political class, the people in the establishment have been sort of captured, and they're more interested in like holding on to their power than they are sort of really pushing the system. I don't know how widespread the view is. I think it'd be hard for me to really answer that question without any really detailed polling. I'm not going to get anytime soon. But that's sort of the conflict is between those people and the people in the black establishment who say, look, we're pushing a country that is majority white forward as much as it can go. We were involved in a lot of civil rights movement. We were involved in getting like the Obamacare passed. We were involved in a lot of policy that has helped black people. And you're dismissing us to say that we're not trying. Like if you ask James Clyburn, he would say, I've done a lot to advance black interests. Look at Obamacare. I helped Barack Obama win 2 terms. So I think it's a real question about what this looks like. Of course, this conversation being a lot about what are your assumptions about non-black people. So part of the conversation is not what is the best policy, but if you're a black politician, the question is, what do I think white people will accept as a policy is really what we're talking about here. And the people on the left are saying we should push really hard for the policies we agree with. Less funding for police, reparations, the Green New Deal, things that will benefit black people disproportionately. We should push for those things. And the people in the middle, you know, the sort of Hakeem Jeffries types are saying, hey, if we push that stuff, we're going to lose elections and we'd rather have a moderate Democrat than a Republican in charge. I think that's the core debate is it's a little bit of a electability, practicality debate that's really about kind of how you see the electorate that's being sort of debated by proxy in some ways.
You know, when we're talking about the electability, the pragmatic strain of things, I mean, Cedric Richmond, who's Biden's campaign chair, and I believe the former head of the Congressional Black Caucus, not current.
He was at some point. Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. When I interviewed him last summer, it was right after the Biden crime bill stuff had come out, and he and Clyburn struck the same tone when they were talking about younger black voters' response to Biden's record. They were saying like, well, this is what black voters wanted at the time, and younger people don't understand that they're standing on the shoulders of accomplishments, right? There is like a certain amount of irritation, I think, from not just like moderate black leaders, but like moderate Democrats in general about the younger left, because they feel like, I mean, for lack of a better way to put it, they feel irritated that they're not being given sort of the historical nod. I wonder if this current protest movement has maybe shaken some of that irritation a little bit, because it has been such a youth-led movement, obviously captured the national attention in this wholesale way, more so than, let's say, like the 2014 Black Lives Matter initial sort of protests that came up. So I'm kind of curious to know whether or not the current moment and like the role of younger Black activists shifts the thinking, that irritation from older or moderate Democrats saying like, you don't remember what we did, where they might say like, okay, it's a bit of a new paradigm. Gen Z is pretty activist-y, and maybe we need to kind of like think about it differently. I don't know. I'm just sort of spitballing here about the psychology of people, which is not something that there are like numbers on. But I am curious if this moment changes some of that dynamic, particularly on the Biden campaign.
Kind of related to that, Claire, you know, we do have this microcosm of this decision in John Lewis's district itself. Because of Georgia election law, the Georgia Democratic Party has to pick a replacement for him on the November ballot extremely soon. Actually, the business day after a candidate dies, they have to pick it, which is obviously very soon. But that means that they are currently, as we record this on Monday, considering among five different finalists. By the time this podcast is released, you guys might know who it is. But what I thought was interesting about the list is that looking at the list through the lens of Perry's article from the other day about the seven different wings of Black politicians, you had two members, I think, of the Black left. You had two of the younger establishment Democrats, and you had one of the older establishment Democrats, this, you know, the group that, you know, that Lewis himself belonged to. And I think it'll be very interesting to see who they choose. You know, the committee who is choosing Lewis's successor is itself made up of Georgia Democratic Party insiders. So I kind of think that, you know, there is an inside track here. The front runner, I believe, is Nicomo Williams, who is the chair of the Georgia Democratic Party. And she's one of these, she's 41 years old, I believe. She's basically the epitome of this younger establishment Democratic Black politician that Perry described in his article. But it will be interesting to see, you know, the fact that there were two of these progressives on the list of finalists was interesting. Maybe it was just a nod to the quote-unquote ascendancy, to use that term again, of that wing of the party. You know, it'll be interesting to see regardless.
I mean, the other decision that's trapped in this debate a little bit is like who you're picking for vice president. Because the gap in the Democratic Party, I would argue, is almost entirely about age and very little about race. And that the under 45, over 45 fight is the sort of gets at every issue in the Democratic Party. And a lot of the Kamala Harris support is not really Black people, but Black people over 45 and Black people in the sort of political establishment. And so this pit gets at this question about, like, you're seeing sort of younger activists say who are Black say, I prefer somebody who's more left. I don't want a prosecutor. They're sort of pointing in Warren's direction. And so I think this VP pick will be interesting in this context as well, in that I'm guessing if you pick Harris, hopefully Biden's staff, just for their own sake, is aware of this. This is not going to be cheered by every Black person in the country by any means, because there is real diversity and a real fight about what kind of person best represents Black interests, if that's a Black person. And obviously, a Black person, like Black people, want a Black person. But that said, what their ideology is really matters in this era in a way that maybe it didn't 15 years ago.
Yeah. Are we describing here these different camps of Black politics? It does make you wonder, is this very much the same conversation that just exists within the broader Democratic Party and amongst white Democrats too? Where are the contrasts here? You know, are they kind of the same debate, Perry?
Oh, yeah. The piece was not trying to suggest Black people live on some kind of special planet. I think in part the piece was trying to get at that, which is like Jamal Bowman and Elliot Engel are running in this race. And the Black members of the CBC endorse the white guy, Elliot Engel, because he is part of the moderate wing. And then you had all of these sort of non-Black people endorse Jamal Bowman because they are left people. Yes, if you're watching what's going on in politics and you sort of, the racial lens in some ways is blinding what's actually happening, which is that there is a fight over like establishment, centrist, so on. I do think the one thing that is interesting is that the singular most famous Black politician in America is sort of hard to categorize. And I think that's why it's interesting. Is like, I know people are going to be like, how can you say Barack Obama is not part of the establishment? But if you listen to what Barack Obama says a lot, he's not trying to be in the Clyburn wing or the Presley wing. He's trying to stay somewhere in between. And I think he's very aware that the youth might win the movement in the future, but the establishment is still winning it right now. And so in that sense, I do think that the sort of the most famous people in politics who are Black, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, Stacey Abrams, and Barack Obama, maybe Michelle Obama even, Susan Rice, are all a little bit hard to categorize. I called them the Obamaites, which is not meant to say that they're like loyal to Obama. I'm not sure Kamala Harris is closer to Obama than Jim Clyburn is. What I was trying to say was they're trying to this sort of middle path. And there's some white politicians who are doing this too. I think Pete Buttigieg would say he's trying to be not really with the left or the center. So I agree with you, Galen. It was the divide sides I'm describing are in the broader Democratic Party. I just think that part of it is like people often think of like there's a black vote in the Democratic Party and there are certain black voices and the CBC is one voice. The CBC is increasingly has three or four different wings in it. Black politics in terms of voters has, you know, a conservative bloc, a liberal bloc, and most importantly, an older bloc and a younger bloc. And I think those are all really important distinctions that are happening right now.
Yeah. It's also because I think that those, let's say, establishment older CBC members are like many Democrats for a long time. They didn't talk about the term structural racism is so a part of America's like news political conversation, not like in political science classes, which is so fascinating to me because that's a really big change. And so candidates on the left who talk about structural racism and, you know, read racism and point out racism in housing and schooling, you know, some of the stuff that Perry took a look at white voters' views on, Americans don't traditionally, particularly white America, they've said, I'm not a racist because I believe in, and then you could put out sort of like the top most racialized issues in the country. People like Warren or people like Sanders, who were popular with younger people, Sanders in particular, right? And then younger black people within that group, talk more about those issues, right? The lens of race is clicked into place a lot more in a lot more of just the run-of-the-mill political issues that we're all talking about, which I think is different from, you know, if you were running in the 90s or early 2000s for a Democratic seat in wherever, and you were black or white, you probably talked about it, but you didn't talk about it all the time, racism, right? Like you were sort of, you would say, well, I'm an economic candidate, right? Like that's what I'm talking about. Now, Warren or Sanders will say, race and economics are completely tied up, right? Which, to be fair here, Dr. King was quite a radical in a lot of ways, right? Which gets washed out of the history a little bit for lots of reasons, right? So this stuff has always been tied together. But I think particularly during like the Clinton centrist years post-Reagan, there was a little bit of like fuzzing out some of that stuff. And so now it's coming into a lot clearer view, if that makes sense. And it's being talked about so much. I mean, talking about feminism, people talk about intersectionality. I remember having a couple of interns here 3 years ago. We have like a women's Slack channel, and they were talking about, someone was saying, I can't believe like people don't know what intersectionality was. And I was like, I didn't know what that was in college. I wasn't a feminist studies major or anything, but like that's something that like every college kid knows now. So these things that are part of the mainstream conversation now are actually quite different than they were even 10 years ago when Barack Obama was president.
Yeah. And it's worth mentioning here that in more ways than one, we're in a different political world from the one that John Lewis entered when he joined the House. You know, in 2019, for the first time in history, black representatives in Congress had numbers that are about proportional to the black population in America. I learned this while I was researching this segment. That's 12%. So 12% of the House is black members. And when you start to have larger numbers like that, you see more of a diversity of opinion and more of a real reflection of how broad the views may be within the black population. Whereas in the 60s, before the Voting Rights Act, before these districts were drawn, people may be excused for thinking there's just one black vote, there's just one black dominant view. And that's clearly not the case anymore, as you laid out for us, Perry. So I think it'll be interesting to watch how this conversation goes forward.
I thought it was interesting, you know, in the many remembrances of Congressman Lewis's life, you know, one anecdote that came out was about his original speech at the March on Washington, which was farther left, was more radical than organizers, including Dr. King, wanted it to be. And in fact, it came out against the Voting Rights Act and said, this doesn't go far enough. And in many ways, it shows that these divides have been around for a long time, but maybe mainstream media or whatever you want to call it is only starting to pick up on them now.
That's a great point. I think these divides have always existed. I think maybe they weren't in Congress. Maybe we weren't covering them well. Black Lives Matter has sort of opened up a political space, and the divide is more obvious between, you know, in Washington, D.C. has a black female mayor and the activists think she sucks. And so it becomes very clear there's a very strong divide. And so I think it's more obvious. But these divides have existed the whole, like, there were black critics of Obama the entire time he was president.
Yeah.
It was not as if those, Cornel West being the most famous of them, but it's not as if these divides don't exist. I think I have a better appreciation for them. I think other people are covering them more. I think the elections of like an Ayanna Pressley made them more obvious and made those voices more prominent. You know, Keith Ellison was in the House for a while, is now the Attorney General of the state. So I think part of it is not these divides didn't exist, but they've been clarified. But I think Galen made a very important point that I wish I had said in my piece. In some ways, the Black Democratic divides are the same as the Democratic divides, and it's worth thinking about it just very simply. This similar kind of left versus right, established versus non-establishment, young versus old, and that's the real fight here. Maybe is about not about race, but about age and generation, and sort of ideology.
I kind of wonder if, you know, we were saying like that these left versus, you know, more centrist divides have always existed within the party, but also in Black politics. You know, the role of Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton as kind of these really prominent figures who were outspoken and connected to the civil rights movement and then very far left and then caricatured or criticized heavily by American media, particularly American right-wing media. I kind of wonder how much that dominated people's view of the Black left for a long time. There's sort of this like sticky thing you get into, right, where people kind of will make fun of Sharpton for, oh, he always just wants to get in front of a podium. Yes, Al Sharpton is everywhere. He is a figure who, you know, he has his own TV show. That's not a mistake, right? But he was also a person who is out there going to these places for a reason and standing behind the podium for a reason. But I think it was very easily caricatured for quite a number of years, for a couple of decades, as that's what the Black left is. Oh, it's just attention seeking. It's just Al Sharpton. Like, it was kind of the superficial understanding of what it was.
And to say this, and to maybe close here, is a friend of the show, Jamel Bowie, wrote this great piece about Jesse Jackson's 1988 campaign for Slate magazine when he was still there. And it gets into the point is the Democratic Party, like when Obama ran in 08, it was kind of cast as in Obama's running a realistic campaign, unlike the last Black person, Jesse Jackson. And the media, right, myself included, kind of framed that in a positive way. It's true, Barack Obama won the nomination and was president. So in terms of electability, I agree his platform may have been more palatable at the time for America, Obama's as opposed to Jesse Jackson's. That said, the way Jesse Jackson ran in 88, the more populist, the more economically liberal, that's where the Democratic Party, I would argue, is going right now in a certain way. And a lot of Jesse Jackson's rhetoric is the kind of thing Sanders and Warren, and to some extent even Joe Biden, is how they sound right now.
Yeah. Amazing how things change, but they also stay the same. Let's move on and talk about the race for the Senate.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
The contest for the Senate has gone from an uphill battle for Democrats to, at least for now, a real possibility with multiple paths to a majority. It's also, of course, a highly consequential race. If the Democrats control the Senate and Biden wins, they'd likely control all of elected government at the federal level. Let's dig in. And before we talk about any of the specific races, Nathaniel, can you characterize the state of the race for the Senate for us?
Sure. So I'll come on with a hot take that I feel like people might not all agree with. But, you know, I'm not sure that framing was quite right, Galen. I think that the Senate has always been in play, at least since the 2018 elections. And I think recently, as kind of Biden has gained on Trump in the polls, I think that it's now become Democrats' race to lose. So the state of play is that Republicans currently enjoy a 53-47 majority in the Senate, which means that Democrats need to flip three seats plus the vice presidency, which the vice president breaks tie votes in the Senate, or Democrats can just flip four seats outright and not win the vice presidency in order to take control of the Senate. My read on the situation right now is that Democrats are clearly favored to flip Arizona and Colorado. Republicans, on the other hand, are clearly favored to flip Doug Jones's seat in Alabama. So I think you can put right in the bank right now a Democratic gain of one. And then I think you have several toss-up seats. So that would be things like Iowa, Maine, North Carolina, Montana, the two Georgia seats.
You think the two Georgia seats are toss-ups?
I think definitely the John Ossoff, David Perdue race is a toss-up based on just looking at the polls. Biden is basically tied with Trump in the polls right now. Of course, that could change. I'm talking about right now. I'm not necessarily convinced that Biden is going to win the election by 9 points nationally. But yeah, the second Georgia race, the special election, has a bit more of a complicated dynamic. As many readers probably know, it's a jungle primary race. So everybody runs on the same ballot in November. And then if nobody gets a majority, which looks very likely, there will be a runoff in January, actually after the 117th Congress is sworn in, which is interesting. So in runoffs, turnout usually drops off. That tends to favor Republicans. So that race might continue to lean Republican. But I think big picture, there are many toss-up races. By definition, a toss-up is a coin flip. If you flip five or six coins, that comes up heads, aka Democratic, three times. So I think the kind of median outcome right now is the Democrats will take maybe 51, 52 seats.
So hold on, let me clarify for listeners, because we talk about this in two different ways sometimes. One, we talk about what we expect to happen on election day, which is what our formal forecast does. And then we can also sometimes talk about what if this election happened right now. So Nathaniel, are you describing the situation if the Senate elections happened today on July 20th, or how you expect those elections to play out 3.5 months from now?
Yeah, that's fair. I'm kind of purposefully being vague there. You know, I guess I'll come out and say,
gotcha.
I'm doing the nowcast right now.
You're doing the nowcast. Okay.
Yeah. And I know we love our nowcasts here at 538. Just kidding. We abolished the nowcast. But it's just easier to say, based on the polls right now, X will happen. I can't predict whether the pandemic will get worse, whether it'll get better, whether aliens will invade and Donald Trump will give an Independence Day style speech and rally support to his cause. But I do tend to think that things aren't going to change that much between now and an election day. But I would say certainly as the polls stand right now, if you just were to take it literally, a lot of these leads for Democrats are like 1 or 2 points. I think like Cal Cunningham in North Carolina is up by only a narrow margin in most polls. But I think that clearly Democrats have a path to, again, like I said, I think a median outcome is that they win maybe a slightly majority, 51 seats. But quite frankly, in a Democratic wave environment, they have a path to 55 seats.
Okay, so some hot takes there. Claire and Perry, let's weigh in on a couple things. First of all, Colorado, Arizona, and Alabama, are you willing to acknowledge that those are foregone conclusions? Alabama goes to Republicans, Arizona and Colorado go to Democrats?
Working here for 4 years has told me that I'm never supposed to say anything like that.
I've only worked here for 2 years, so I guess I have some training to catch up on.
Some leeway. You have some mistakes to make.
You weren't here
for 2016, buddy.
Yeah. Listen, I profiled Doug Jones like 6 months after he won his Senate seat. And part of the premise of that piece was basically like, this guy doesn't have that much time in Senate. What's he going to do with it, right? So, Doug Jones has always... Alabama is interesting because there are actually quite a lot of Democrats there, particularly Black Democrats, who, Doug Jones could count on for lots of votes. But yeah, I don't think Doug Jones is probably going to win there. So I think, sure, for the sake of being a conversation sake, yes, those are all seats that I think are pretty predictable.
Here's, I think, a big question coming away from 2018, which is that in 2018, how a state voted in the presidential election in 2016 was the most important factor in determining how that state voted in the Senate. And so you saw, even in a Democratic wave environment, Democratic senators still lose in Missouri, in Indiana, for example. So when I look at the Cook Political Report, they're considering Montana and Arizona and North Carolina to be toss-ups. They're considering Georgia to be lean R, although you said toss-up. Iowa, lean R. Kansas, lean R. Does this mean that we expect that some of those states like Montana, Georgia, North Carolina could still go to Trump and voters would be splitting their tickets? Or do we think that if a Democrat is going to win the Senate race in these states, it also means that they are going to vote for Biden in the presidential election?
I assume the answer is depends on which state. Right. Is that what you were saying, Nathaniel? Like, I think the governor of Montana is a particularly unique candidate who might do well. So I think Bullock in Montana is like polling really well. And the state by state rules, I'm not totally sure apply to him. Like, if Bullock loses in Montana, he'll lose by a lot less than Biden loses. Versus I think in North Carolina, I don't think Tom Tillis will get a single vote of anyone who doesn't vote for Trump, too. But I'll defer to Nathaniel, but I sort of think the deuce, you know, how much is the state, how much is the partisan effect relevant depends on which state, right?
Right, totally. So, you know, we have this concept of 538 called elasticity. It's how persuadable the voters are, and related to that concept is split ticket voting. Montana is a particularly elastic state as a small state. In addition, it's a state where personalities can kind of play an outsized role. And Steve Bullock, he was elected as governor for two terms, and he was a popular governor, so he has a personality. Everybody knows Steve Bullock. They don't perceive him as like Barack Obama or even Joe Biden and DC Democrats that they don't like. But yeah, North Carolina is a perfect example of a state where things tend to go in lockstep up and down the ballot. One exception is the governor's race there, where the incumbent Democrat Roy Cooper is pretty popular and probably will run ahead of Biden and Cal Cunningham, the Democratic nominee for Senate, although not every poll agrees with that.
Okay, so we do expect not a repeat of 2018 necessarily when it comes to the Senate.
Yeah, so, you know, just personally handicapping things, I would say that the Democrats' fates in the Senate race in North Carolina and Georgia and maybe Iowa hinge on the presidential outcome there. But kind of the strength of individual candidates stands out for Montana, certainly. Maine, kind of the reverse, where Susan Collins has this moderate Republican reputation. And so she can probably withstand Biden carrying Maine, as he will probably do. But
you Wait, know, you think she's going to be reelected?
No, I think that's a toss-up. But
I think she'll do better than...
I think that Biden is going to win Maine by Maine for sure. 10 points. Right. And I think that it's, you know, like there are
She'll
clearly people who
Trump.
Are willing to split their tickets. Exactly. The question is how much better, you know, it's close enough that we can't make a call. I think Kansas is an interesting case because that's a race where it's about the weakness of the Republican candidate. And that primary is coming up in a couple of weeks in August. But Kris Kobach, who listeners probably know, is the former Secretary of State of Kansas who ran for governor, lost in 2018 because he's a very controversial figure. He's a very zealous crusader against voter fraud and has gotten in trouble for overstepping. He was held in contempt of court related to his, you know, possibly illegal enforcement of these laws. But if he gets nominated as a Republican Senate candidate in Kansas, that puts that race probably in the toss-up column as well. If it is a more conventional Republican nominee, such as Congressman Roger Marshall, I think you can take that one off the board and say that Republicans will hold it easily. So the lean R rating is kind of splitting the difference between those two possibilities, but I don't think it's actually lean R. I think it's either a toss-up or solid R.
Interesting. Yeah, there's been reporting that a Democratic group is trying to boost Kris Kobach there in Kansas. It would be, if a Democrat won the Senate race, the first time since 1932. Of course, in part because of Kris Kobach, or entirely because of Kris Kobach, a Democrat won the governor's race there in 2018. So that could be, you know, some significant damage done by Kris Kobach there in Kansas. As we wrap up here, we get plenty of questions about the Senate and what the most important factors are. One of them, of course, is the presidential race. Another is cash. We've seen Democrats running in these Senate races just raking in cash on sites like Act Blue, and their Republican opponents not necessarily being able to keep up. What did we learn about the role of cash in 2018, and do we think it applies this time around as well?
Cash rules everything, right? That's like modern American politics, is that it's good to have more money, particularly in big media markets, especially if the polling in the presidential race stays as it has been, with Biden quite out in front. I think you'll see a lot more grassroots attention and media attention being turned to the Senate. That's not to say that the Senate races will ever overshadow the presidential one, but I think from a fundraising point of view, you have a lot of people more freed up logistically and, you know, mental space to turn their attention to these races. And, you know, I think you're already seeing, like, John Ossoff, who had, what, the most expensive congressional race, is now seeing, you know, you're seeing him rake in a bunch of money for his Senate race in Georgia. So I think you're going to see more concerted attention to these places, which is good for, I guess, candidates on both sides, but particularly for Democrats who feel safe potentially in the knowledge that their top of the ticket candidate in Biden is doing pretty well, and that they can go and sort of try to pick off people in you know, it's cheaper to win a Senate race, I guess, all things considered, than the White House.
So my sense is we should sort of ignore the fundraising numbers. I know that this is a not a normal take in this case, because I live in Kentucky, where Amy McGrath just raised more money in a quarter than Mitch McConnell did. And I think that means that there's a lot of money and a lot of enthusiasm for beating Mitch McConnell. I don't think that's going to necessarily correlate very much to support. And so I would say the same thing in South Carolina, where Lindsey Graham is running against Jamie Harrison. Jamie Harrison's raised a lot of money. So I think we're going to have a lot of races where Democrats raise a lot of money and maybe even raise more than the Republican does. But I just think it's important not to indicate that, hey, I'm not saying Claire did this. I'm just saying in general, like, I know in Kentucky you got it covered a lot. Amy raised more money than Mitch McConnell did. Yeah. I don't think that tells us anything, really, about anything. So
I think those two races in particular, though, it's like, yeah, people, because Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell are like the names, those races get a lot of money. I think, like, potentially I'm trying to think of, like, the celebrities who are very political, like Stephen Colbert or that type of person. You could see them in the last 2 months of the election kind of turning their attention to these, like, random, quote-unquote, Senate races that people don't know that well, and there being a concerted effort for people to give smartly, right? Because I think a lot of times people give emotionally, and they say, if they're a Democrat, I hate Mitch McConnell, I hate Lindsey Graham, I see them all the time in the news, and they stink. They might not know who John Ossoff is in Georgia, although maybe there's a better example. They might not know who Gideon is in Maine, but they'll say, someone told me to give her money, so I'm going to give her money. Like, I think that you potentially see in the last couple of months of the election, people more giving more strategically rather than emotionally. Although maybe that's, like, who am I to predict that about people and their money in politics? Like, you know, but I think that there's a potential for that.
I think the Democrat, in other words, what I'm saying is I think the Democrat may raise more money in all 10 races we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that'll correlate to victory very closely. That's all I mean. Yeah.
But I do think that if it were 50-50 and the Democrat raised more money in 5 races and Republicans raised more money in 5 races, that Democrats would win more races in the 10 out of 10 scenario than the 5 out of 5 scenario. I think overall it is indicative of Democratic enthusiasm.
Yeah, because if I recall correctly, in our 2018 congressional model, we did weight donations, and we said, you know, whether or not spending the money actually gets you support, it's a measurement of enthusiasm, and that can be a good indicator for trying to figure out who's going to win the election in the long run.
Right. So there are two components to fundraising. So for the reason you mentioned, Galen, our model uses, I believe it's the individual contributions line. So, you know, it wouldn't account for things like candidates self-funding. Fundraising does represent one of the only pre-election acts of actual voter support. So there's that indicator, which is positive for Democrats. But then there's also the more obvious one, which is Mark Kelly has $20 million or however much it is that he can use to air ads to knock Martha McSally into oblivion. And that's also clearly an advantage. We know from political science that money makes a difference in politics.
The other story worth tracking here is if in October Joe Biden is ahead by 8 to 10 points, I think you're going to see a shift in the Republican Party, and they're going to say, hey, House is gone. Presidency is gone. We have to save the Senate. Donors, this is the, you know, socialism is coming unless you give, send all your money to three or four races. And I think that will, particularly like the outside groups, that's why I think those are so important. If you have a flood of $7 million from outside group Y attacking Sarah Gideon, that could make, that could lift Susan Collins, even if Biden wins that state easily. That's what I'm looking for, is because I think the Senate dynamic is going to be shaped by, if it seems like Biden's going to win, the Republican Party, I think you're sort of seeing signs of it already. Republican candidates kind of, who are running for the Senate, kind of criticizing Trump. I wonder if that gets louder by October.
All right. Well, of course, we will learn in time how this all shakes out, but we're going to leave it there for today. So thank you so much, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
Thanks, Perry.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Nathaniel.
Thank you, Galen.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we will see you soon.